Taking a look at the world of insects today here on the Ideas Network and focusing a bit on fall invaders on the show. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. Great to have Phil Pelletieri back with us, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus. He retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab back in 2014, but he stops by every couple of months to talk with you and with me about insects and what kinds of insects may be bothering you or just are of interest to you. And I hope you'll join in today as we move along. Already, every one of our lines is filled, but here's the number. It's 1-800-642-1234. Also, you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And if you have a photo that you can send along, maybe there's an insect you want identified, email it to us, and Phil will take a look at it and see what we can come up with by way of explanation of that bug. Phil Pelletieri, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Nice to be here, Larry.
So, which insects are likely to invade homes at this time of year?
Well, the first one on the list are cluster flies, which are the ones that some people call winter house flies because they look very similar. And as early as probably the 1st of September, and even a few days earlier than that, especially in the northern part of the state, they'll start coming in. And then we have this whole litany of box elder bugs and marmorated stink bugs and Asian lady beetles. You know, so you're talking well into middle October and even later if the weather allows. And so the fall is a bit of a problem for these insects that look for a nice sheltered place to spend the winter.
And what do you do? You know, say you wind up with a batch of cluster flies or yeah. Whatever.
Well, the whole game really is to not let them get in. Right? Because once they get in the wall, there really is no magic to stop these things. And so, you know, sometimes it is quite obvious, you know, you don't have the proper screening on your vents or those kind of things. Sometimes the pattern, if they only show up in the bathroom and nowhere else, then you start to think about a vent fan that's not screened properly. But caulking and sealing, and the general rule is if critters fly, you want to seal high, you know, overhangs, yeah. That kind of thing. If critters crawl, then it's usually that interface between your siding and your foundation that needs to be sealed up. If you can't seal them up, then the strategy is to spray the outside of the structure again before they get in. And so that's why this is kind of time to at least think about it. We're still a couple weeks away from when you really have to do something. But the thing about the physical keeping them out, that's a permanent solution. If you solve the riddle, yeah. It's well worth it and the like. Whereas the problem with the spraying is whatever you do one year doesn't really influence what's going to happen the next.
You mentioned that also that you wanted to talk about grubs and skunks.
Well, yeah, this is always a bit of a dilemma because usually in September and October, if you either have raccoons or skunks coming in and tearing a bunch of turf, that's because there's a bunch of grubs there. And it can be Japanese beetle in the southern part of the state. It can be white grubs in any part of the state. The white grubs have a three-year life cycle, and they're really much harder to predict. But again, if animals are tearing up your turf, there's got to be a good food source for them. And it really is kind of a dilemma because, the grubs are harder to kill at that time of the year. If you could kill the grubs, they'd stop coming. But what's really quite amazing, you know, historically, we've seen some cases where it looks like you almost put a rotor tiller in, yeah. That did so much damage. And honestly, with a little bit of work, the lawn is just fine the next year. So, you know, it's not the end of the world. But as I said, it's worth investigating. And what I would suggest is if there's more than about 2 grubs per square foot, that's the kind of densities that either is going to damage the lawn or, again, bring this wildlife to come in.
And lots of callers online. So let's go to the phones. Bob and Cronenwetter are up first with a question. Hi, Bob.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for the opportunity to talk. Timing couldn't be more perfect. Last night, I was out in my yard. I was coiling up my hose after doing a little watering, and where I typically coil it is right on the edge of a kind of a plant and flower area that has a little small rock border to it. And as I was bending over to pick up the sprinkler, all of a sudden, I noticed this swarm of bees all of a sudden starting to attack me, and two of them got me before I could get far enough away to get out of their little area. And so I stood there and watched them for a little bit. And they're really small. They're probably not much bigger than a housefly. They've kind of a light golden brown in color and real frantic. Why they get an object that they're concerned with and they're just buzzing around it. And then when I went out there this morning to see if they're still there, I noticed them crawling into a little hole beneath one of the rocks. So I kind of figured they must have a nest there. But with all the concern about bees and flowers and pollen and whatnot, I'm not sure what I should do, if I should do anything. But I don't want to have another visit like last night from them.
Right. So be honest, they're not bees. You know, the only colony bees that we have are bumblebees, which are the big fuzzies that we're all used to seeing, and honeybees, which, you know, most people are pretty familiar with. And honeybees won't nest in the ground. When we start talking about colony forms in the wasp group, then we get a lot of ground nesting paper wasps. And we have a number of species, and I suspect that's what you've got. And, you know, it's typical these things start with a queen in the spring. So we really don't see much activity until we get late summer. And then their numbers are finally high enough. And that's also when they take the greatest defense, when the nest is disturbed. So a couple options. I'm real leery about just saying put a bunch of dirt there and bury it, because I've seen them dig their way out or come from other directions. If it was in a place that there was not people and pet traffic, you'd say, well, you can let them be because they will freeze out when we get, you know, 2-3 months down the road. But if it is an area of a lot of traffic, the secret for ground nests and other nests that you cannot see, the aerosol wasp sprays really don't perform very well because you often don't get them where you need to, but by using a dust type insecticide. And so, you know, the general garden dust like 7 would be quite effective. And what you do is you wait until either late, you know, almost sunset or right away in the morning, and just treat that area and then just leave it. And usually in a matter of 3 or 4 hours, it will do them in. And why the dusts are so effective is they have to come in and out of that hole. They get the dust on their bodies, and that's what kills them.
There you go. Thanks so much for calling, Bob. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Kevin in Madison up next. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We have stink bugs, and we noticed them for the first time this past winter, where we had quite a number of them in the upstairs of our house. And this summer, they have shown particular interest in our cucumbers. And I can only imagine that in the next few weeks, they're just going to come right back inside. And so I'm wondering if there is a particular way that stink bugs try to enter a house.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, most of these fall invaders come in on the sunny sides, you know, because of the temperature fluctuations you get in the fall. Sometimes it's too cool on the shady sides to be active. And so I would definitely would look in. And as I said, if I find the weakness in most homes, it's the overhang. And even in brand new homes, you know, often what they have there is a piece of kind of waffled plastic that just kind of fits in a couple grooves. And there's little spaces, you know, every 3 to 4 inches that's quite easy for insects to squeeze in. As I mentioned earlier, too, you know, any kind of soffit vent, make sure that either the openings are small enough or there's some kind of screening behind it or in front of it so something as big as a stink bug cannot crawl through. Any place you've got loose siding, again, you can consider about stuffing things. You also have to pay particular attention around any kind of piping or other things come up to make sure that's tight. But if you mention the top, if you can get access to your roof and walk in the attic, and see if you can see, again, any kind of spacing. And again, I would look at your roof vents as a possibility, because some roof vents are screened, some are not. And if they're not, that is just like a big hole for something like a stink bug to come crawling in.
Would you put anything on the outside of the wall to...
Yeah, you know, we get a lot of research from the East, because they've been battling this problem now for about 10 years, and it's just kind of slowly getting hold here. It's... You know, I was somewhat surprised it's been as slow as it has to take off. I argue this was one of the reasons I retired, because I knew this problem was coming, and it's not an easy one to deal with. I think you can look at spraying the outside, whether you do it yourself or have it commercially done, and especially, you know, 3-story houses, it's often you need somebody that's got specialized equipment. But again, the whole idea is you really got to gang up early, and so I'd say you're okay for a month. even maybe 6 weeks. But for stink bugs, I would look at the end of September, the beginning of October, that if I was going to use an outside chemical along the foundation and again, up high around the soffits. And really, these chemicals probably repel as much as kill, because a lot of these chemicals have that kind of capacity to them. But if you wait until November when you start to notice stink bugs in the house or any time during the winter.
Too late.
Too late.
There you go. Thank you, Kevin, for calling. Judy in Bailey's Harbor, your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. This is not exactly on talk about fall invaders, but I do have problems with a milkweed patch that I have. And, you know, the monarchs have visited and laid their eggs and they've hatched and the caterpillars are there. But there's something else attacking milkweed. And this little insect, well, it's about an inch long and it has an orange stripe down its back, several black legs on either side of the body, and, oh, like in the front and in the back, some little white, almost look like feathers.
There's a critter called a milkweed tussock moth, and this is a caterpillar that has all kinds of interesting hairs and the like, and that's what gives it that kind of leg-like appearance. And usually when you have tussock moth, you have a number of them because that's the way the moth lays her eggs. So you could argue it's a competitor for monarchs, but not really, because there's more than enough milkweed to go around. And so, and it's exclusive to milkweed, so it doesn't attack other kinds of garden plants. So I think you can easily just let it be rather than disturb it. Then the other thing that people might find at this time of the year that I've seen on milkweed, there is a brightish yellow aphid. As we call the milkweed aphid, believe it or not. And they get on some pretty big numbers. But, you know, typical of aphids in the late summer, they come under natural control quite easily. And so, again, that really isn't much of a problem. Monarchs have more problems with general predators like earwigs and those kinds of things that mess with them more so than these, you know, plant-feeding type critters.
There you go, Judy. Thank you so much for calling. So don't worry about it. Right. Too much. I mean, it's not. They're not going to look as pretty, but they're going to.
Yeah, they often when they feed, they leave kind of a lacy network of veins behind. So and that itself is almost artistic if you like that kind of thing. So
there you go, Jake in Milwaukee. We turn to you next. Hi, Jake.
Hey, thank you. Hey, I do lawn care part time, and I'm coming across a lot of my lawns that have some heavy insect damage. And by the time they call me, they're big chunks of the lawn are almost devastated. Mm-hmm. And then as I go from lawn to lawn and check it out, the one constant seems to be a lot of moth activity in each lawn. And then they seem to be, if I keep on the same routes of doing lawns, the first house will have a lot of insect damage. And the next three or four homes on that route will have insect damage. It's like, for one, could it be moths? And two, could I be tracking it from lawn to lawn?
Yeah, no, I'm not worried about you tracking it. And you know, as you know, but people may not be aware, lawns are a real difficult thing to try to sort through why you've got brown patches. I will say overall, I tended to see a lot more disease issues than insects. In the moth group, there's a critter called a sod webworm. There also is some types of cutworm. And even once in a great while, we get army worms, which are all grass feeders. By far, the more prevalent of the three would be the webworms. These are those little moths that you kick out when you walk through the lawn, and almost any lawn will have some webworms. It takes a pretty high density to see what's going on there. And as you mentioned, one of the frustrations, if they ever do get bad enough to start to cause some damage, by the time you witness it, you're already about 2 weeks too late. And so it is in all the years, you know, 30 plus years I was chasing critters, I think there's probably 3 or 4 years I can think of that there was what I would call significant widespread webworm damage. And even then, it kind of grew out of it. But going back to, as I said, if things are progressing, what would happen if you got into those areas and the edges of where it's browning out and you started digging around? There's a little white caterpillar with a dark head, which is the larvae, and you would find a number of them. There are some products that you can get, including some detergents that you can put on a lawn to kind of flush these things. And so that's one way to make the diagnosis. But the only time you would treat is if you still had worms there. As I said, if you're to the point of seeing the moths there, it's over and it's not a reoccurring problem. The one other comment I'll make as far as potential insect problems that can be widespread, there's a critter called a chinch bug that primarily attacks very exposed parts of the lawn, you know, south sides and the like. It would not attack stuff that's in shaded areas. That can be devastating. but it typically needs drought conditions. And just the general rainfall patterns this year, I'd be quite surprised. Now, if we don't get rain for the next 6 weeks, we can have some fall chinch bug damage. But I just don't think the weather has been conducive for that this year. And so, you know, if things, it's still kind of hard to put the puzzle together, it will be worth taking a sample of turf in the plant disease lab. We'll look at it for a fee. But often, as I said, when I'm perplexed, it's worth looking at that just to sort through, to rule out the disease side. And as I said, I tend to find that the disease is much more responsible for brown patches and turf than the insects that we have in this state. Yeah,
there you go. So the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW would be the place to send
us. Right, and you can even go on Brian's site there. He's got information both on what some of these turf diseases look like when they show up, but also, directions as far as how to send a sample in C. But as I said, I just don't think you're going to have to worry about putting insecticide on. I often tell people the probability of having an insect problem that needs chemical treatment in this state is less than 1%. And that's why we used to get quite annoyed when it was standard practice to put insecticides on lawns. And you say, boy, you're throwing a whole lot of chemical out there for no effect.
Yeah.
And even if you do use chemicals, so much it's timing. If you're there 2 weeks too early or too late,
yeah,
why bother?
Forget it. Yeah. There you go, Jake. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Sarah Hopeful, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer on the Ideas Network. Looking at the world of insects here in Wisconsin today with our guest, Phil Pelletieri. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us. One open line at 800-642-1234. And we have some emails as well. The first email, I'm not seeing it right now. So there we go. Wally emailed that he recently found some goldenrod structures, which aroused his curiosity, and he took them apart. The growing top of the plant is bent down and leaves whirled around. Undoing the leaves reveals a clutch of black-brown eggs at the base of each leaf. Who would be laying those eggs?
Well, there's a whole bunch of critters that get in goldenrod, and a lot of them are gall insects that will cause funny growths, and the grubs live inside. But because these eggs are outside, my first guess is there are some leaf beetles that are quite common on goldenrod. They turn into kind of warty alligator-looking like larvae that eat the leaves. And then the adults are kind of a yellowish-brown insect. And so I bet you those are leaf beetle eggs because they often lay them in little clutches like that. And, again, you know, it doesn't really hurt the goldenrod. There may be some moths, as I said. We could probably come up a list of 60 or 70 things you could expect on goldenrod. But the leaf beetle group is probably the one I see the most often.
Let's turn to Mark in Cashton next. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, hi, Larry and Phil. Last night I was out on my deck, and I was watching some small insects swarm, and they appeared to be just slightly bigger than flies. I looked under the deck, and there's a nest about the size of two softballs together, and there are hundreds of... Now I can see that they are in the wasp family, but they're very, very small. And they do have yellow and black on them, and it's what I would call a yellow jacket, but I don't know for sure. And I don't know how to get rid of them. The nest is in a tight spot, and, of course, our deck is an entertainment area, and it's where our dogs go out during the day, and everybody kind of hangs out here, and... When they swarm, it's a small cloud, and got me concerned.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, what's got me a little confused is that we typically, swarms are typically a mating practice in some insects where you have clouds of males and then the females come through, but wasps don't work that way, typically, and so I'm a little perplexed. Does it really appear that the critters that are swarming are the same ones you saw on the soil surface?
Well, I think what it is whenever the deck vibrates, then they come up.
Yeah.
And they come up through the slats in the floor, and they come, on the on the edges, and that's when I said swarm. That's probably wrong phraseology.
No,
there,
that's technically a term that's appropriate when you've got all kinds of yellow jackets mad too, and bees swarm. But you know, so it's a different context versus these mating swarms that I said that a lot of flies and other critters use. Okay, well, it's much like the person that called earlier when their ground nests. You somehow have to identify the openings they're coming through. Do you have access under the deck, or is it only like 8 inches high?
No, actually, my deck is about 8 feet off the ground,
mm-hmm.
and I can walk under the deck, and I can see the nest, but it's in a real tight compartment where two 2x10s kind of cross and come together, and you can't, you couldn't get a hose up there without having a bee suit on or something.
Sure.
And I don't know what else to do. I hate to spray. I hate to use spray, but I don't know what...
So the sprays, the benefit of a spray is it's an instant knockdown. So if they're coming at you and you spray, they just knock out of the air. But as I mentioned before, when you can't physically see where the nest is, I don't expect the spray to resolve this. Now, if you... There's not a lot of activity other than you kind of walking slowly and observing. If you can identify a crack or a hole or anything else just to know where they're coming and going from. And in this case, again, a dust is the best way to go. And it's a question of how you deliver the dust. Pest control companies use a product called, it's called a bulb duster, and it's just a little bellows with a little straw. So they can put the straw into whatever opening they see, and then puff, 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 and that's how they dissipate. If I were to do that, I would get as many clothes on as I can, so almost a bee suit, just to protect yourself. And again, you don't want to treat these things in the middle of the day, because the workers that are out and about are going to come back, and they're going to take great offense at the, they're not going to want to land back in there. And so, as I said, we try to ambush them either right away in the morning, or you can even go after dark. If you use red light, insects can't identify that. So as I said, dust, I think, is the way to go. The only question is what makes the most sense physically to get the dust where you need to. An old turkey baster to blow it. I mean, there's other ways of trying to do it. And if it all else fails, you just dust the opening as best you can, get out of there, and see if at least that knocks them down considerably, so then you can go back in there and retreat at a later time.
There you go. Thank you. So, what kind of dust would you use?
Permethrins. I mean, I always used to like 7. 7, to beekeepers is a dirty word. It's very toxic to ants and wasps and bees. But in this case, we want to kill them. And by applying it that way, I mean, honeybees should not get any exposure. It's not like putting it on a flower that a bee's going to come into. And it does break down in a matter of 3 or 4 days. It's not a long residual insecticide.
All right. There you go, Mark. Good luck with that. Appreciate your call. And John in Menominee Falls, we turn to you next. Hi, John.
Hello, Larry. It's been a long time. I'm actually traveling. I'm using a hands-free device, and I'm up around Green Bay. I have like a little prairie garden in my front yard, and I've got a couple plants, and I've got the Dutch version of another one, and I got coneflowers. And on the side of my house, by my garage, by my back door, I've got dahlias, Mystic Illusion dahlias, beautiful yellow flowers. This year, almost all of the flowers on the cup plants, and then I noticed on a few of my dahlias where the petals were being eaten, and I found a couple of places where the leaves were curled, and I'm thinking it must have been what you talked about a little bit earlier, a form of a leaf beetle. The adult, I find them inside the actual center of the dahlia flower. They like to sit there. They're about a quarter inch long, 3/16 of an inch wide, and maybe the same in height. And they're like a brownish, and they're iridescent. Would that be a form of leaf beetle?
Yeah, it is a leaf beetle, but I was in good shape until you said the iridescent, because one of the common problems we get in the late summer is there is an insect called a corn rootworm, and the adult beetles love to feed on the flowers of various plants, including dahlias, probably on the top of the list. So these stinkers come flying in and eat the petals off, and of course that is very disappointing to people that spend all the time babying these plants and the like. But they're not iridescent. One is kind of a yellowish brown with some stripes. The other one is kind of an off green color. But there are lots of different leaf beetles, and that is, but where I'm a little puzzled again is this just feeding on the petal side of things, because that suggests something that doesn't eat dahlias normally. It's just something like the petals of flowers. It'd be worse if you can get a decent picture of one and send it, down to PJ, or send it to Larry one way or another, whether PJ gets a look at it or I do.
Email it to us today.
Yeah, yeah. And then I can give you something a little more definitive. But it is always difficult when plants are in bloom. You really can't treat them because of the pollinators problem. So
there we go. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. David in Arena, your turn now. Hi, David.
Hello, yes. Thank you for having me on.
Sure.
I have, the last two, we live in the woods in a rural area part of the town of Arena in the country. And the last 2 years we've had an onslaught of millipedes that starts about the mid-June around the summer solstice. This year they have lasted into the present time. Last year they ended more quickly. They invade our garage, which is unheated, and it's cool and damp in there. I cleaned the garage out. Every morning, though, I still have to spend an hour or so sweeping and vacuuming up thousands and thousands of these creatures.
Sure.
Pretty much stopped them from getting into the house.
Mm-hmm.
But the garage is a real problem, and I don't know much about their life cycle or anything. We, of course, don't like to use sprays and so forth. So what do you suggest?
Major land use change. this has been an interesting dilemma. Millipedes live in the soil and feed on organic matter. And although they appear on your garage floor, that has nothing to do where they're coming from. In fact, the source could be hundreds of yards away. Usually it's, prairies, CRP ground, something that's got a lot of vegetation that is decaying in the soil. Millipedes do quite well. And honestly, their populations get so high, then they go through this dispersal, and they're doing all this at night. They're crawling around at night, and when the sun comes up, they will accumulate where it's cool, damp, and dark, and that's your garage floor. So, you get this constant migration in, and, if it was 20 feet from the house, I'd say, well, we do this and goes away, but if it's so far away, you have no control of that. And as I said, you don't see this problem in the middle of the city because there's just not that much organic matter. But in the country situation, I've even seen it in no-till cornfields have enough organic matter that it gets big millipede populations. But what generally happens is their populations crash, but it could be a couple, 3 years. It's not necessarily a real sudden type thing. Or as I said, if you see the way the crops around you, if there is any agricultural land change, that could affect where they're migrating from. If indeed in the places where people spray, and it's always kind of iffy, if you can identify where they're coming from, and one of the things you can do is go out at night with a flashlight and just see if you can see these things kind of crawling through, and if it makes sense. If you're going to put any kind of barrier, you put it on the far edge of your property to head them off before they get there. But I go back to Dr. Stan Temple was telling me he was watching, and he could basically verify that it took the millipedes approximately 5 minutes to go almost 100 yards.
Wow.
So at night they can get cruising pretty good. And as I said, this happens to be, and I've got some great pictures in my files of millipedes piling up 4 or 5 inches deep along people's foundations every night. And as I said, because the source is not their backyard, it's really hard to do much that's going to make much of a difference.
Yeah. Wow. So find, if you can find where they're coming from.
Find where they're coming from. In that case, honestly, it's almost worth considering putting what we would call a power spray. We use enough volume. Just going out there with a little can of Raid is not going to get you anywhere. But when they put a barrier up, and again, this is what's done commercially at times. Let's say we've got a motel where these things are migrating and causing problems. They mow the grass out as far as they can, and then that interface between where they stop mowing and where the grass gets, they might put a 8-10 foot barrier of rather large amounts of water, dilute insecticide, to kind of head them off at the pass. And And even that, you know, the argument, if they're coming by the millions and we kill 95% of them, we're all excited because we thought we killed them all. The 5% that gets through are going to be very disappointing for you.
Yeah, there you go. David, thank you so much for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Give a call. Brian in Superior, it's your turn. Hi, Brian.
Hey, thanks, Larry. Good show, like usual.
Thank you.
I had a new house built in 2013. Unfortunately, I don't think the contractors I used really knew what they're doing in some aspects, but that's a different issue. Ever since the house was built, we've had problems with larder beetles, and I've had them examined. I know they're larder beetles, but
yeah. You
know, our house is very tidy. My wife is an excellent housekeeper, and she's a little bit on the far side when it comes to making sure everything's sealed up so nothing gets in any of the food items or what have you.
Okay.
We've had exterminators come, and nobody really seems to put a finger on what's
going on.
Okay. So do you have pets?
Well, we've had this problem prior to pets.
But you have pets now?
But yes, we do.
Okay. So larder beetles belong to a group of carpet beetles and the like, but what makes them somewhat special is their diet has to be a high-protein food source. So, you know, if you have a mouse that dies in your wall, well, fine, you could probably breed 3 or 4 larder beetles out of it. And so they kind of pop in the house and get everybody excited. But, you know, it's not a kind of food source that can sustain populations. If it was something big that died, again, usually the smell and other things get people's attention, not the larder beetles, because they're kind of a late breeder. They don't get on fresh, dead things. They get on dried out type things, mummified almost. And the reason I was fishing about the dog or the pets is they feed on high protein dog food. And I'm just a little concerned that that's not stuffed somewhere.
Oh, that could be it. Thank you very much for calling.
So again, you know, to me, it's a food source thing. You can't spray it.
If
you can find the food source. One other wild one I have seen is where rodents have stole a bunch of dog food, stuffed it in the walls. And even after you get rid of the dog food and the dog, that stuff is still there and breeding them. But we're talking about greasy, high-protein food. It's not a meal-type product. It's stuff that's rather oily is what it would take to sustain it. And because this is being reoccurring, it suggests that your food source is reoccurring, and that's the direction I'd go.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Ann emailed this photo for an ID, and it's a pretty caterpillar with, I'd say, a yellow
sure.
with a bright red head.
So this
the way
this
it
critter
looks.
Is called a yellow-marked tussock moth. And one of the characteristics of tussock moths, they have what we call pencil hairs that almost look like antennae. It's quite common for many of the tussock moths to be brightly colored and really, I mean, almost look like aliens. They're I find them attractive.
They're
but
pretty.
You know. Now, Ann also had said a good resource for identifying caterpillars and moths, it depends how deep you want to get into it. I mean, there are some exquisite books, but honestly, some of the field identification guides that specialize, let's say, just in caterpillars, and there's some, you know, for kids and there's some for adults, you know, rather inexpensive. I think that will get you in the ballpark most of the time. If you really want to get serious and spend a lot of time looking at pictures, there's a site called Bug Guide. And
yeah,
Bug Guide,
I've been on that site.
Has people submit pictures for identification, but then what they do is put them in a database, and you can kind of go through and scroll through all these things and see you can find pictures, but they literally have millions of images. So, as I said, if you're just saying, what is this insect, boy, that's way too many things to look at. If you know it's a caterpillar, at least you're kind of in the ballpark and go from there.
And Harry in Rock Falls wants you to identify these insects, which are almost bee-like.
So the first critter is definitely a bumblebee, and I'm a little suspicious of Rusty Patch, which is a bumblebee that has had some real concerns on populations. I just can't see enough the way the wings are sitting, but it's definitely one of the handful of species of bumblebees we get. The second critter is a little Lycinid. We call them blues. They're little fine butterflies. There's about 4 or 5 species, and would have to see the wings open to be really sure which one it is. And the last critter, at first it looks like a Japanese beetle, but it's not shiny enough. And there is a very close lookalike that's a native insect called a spring rose beetle. And you see this at the late summer, feed on petals of flowers, feeding on corn silk, kind of the same problem. And we only see spring rose beetle in sandy areas. So it's kind of localized to some parts of the state, and that would be my guess. It's definitely a scarab beetle. And again, if you told me up close and personal it was kind of metallic looking, that would be a Japanese beetle. But the spring rose beetle is kind of a dull version of the Japanese beetle and a native insect. So
there we go. Well, let's go back to the phones and to Rod in Madison next. Hi, Rod.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We were at an event about a month ago or so down in the Whitewater area, and there was an insect flying around there. It looked very much like a wasp, but this thing was black or maybe a dark iridescent blue. It had black wings, basically totally black. It was about 2 inches long, quite a mover, walked very quickly, but flew around, was kind of a nuisance. I'm just curious if you'd have an idea what that was.
Sure. It's probably one of the thread-waisted wasps. We call them sphecids, but this particular one is one that commonly is referred to as a cricket hunter. And they go around and pick up crickets and grasshoppers and the like. They dig a little hole, they put the cricket in there, they lay their eggs, and then they're done with it. So they don't live in a nest, per se, when you think about bumblebees and the like. And because of that, they're really very non-aggressive. Now, on the other hand, they're very curious, and so you kind of see them flittering around and crawling underneath things and the like. And again, what they're doing is searching for prey. So it's definitely one of those thread-waisted wasps, and I said I think the cricket hunter, there's about 5 or 6 species you could run into, but that would be the group.
There we go. Thank you for calling, Rod. Ryan in Brilliant, your turn now. Hi, Ryan.
Hello, good afternoon, fellas. We live on a small farmette. It's 20 acres, and we have a lot of ash trees, and we're right on the edge of you know, we can see that we're going to get ash borer. It's going to happen. And so we are going around, and we're removing some of our bigger ash trees, and we were just curious if how this is going to go. Does it mean that, you know, Wisconsin or that our area is not going to ever have ash trees, or should we leave some of the – we have little seedling ones growing – should we leave those growing? Will the beetles move through? And then once they're through, will maybe the young ones have a chance at growing up? Or will we be able to plant new? What's the long-term prognosis for this?
Not good. It's kind of like Dutch elm disease, is that you can have plants that are too small to be attacked. But I think we will see a sustained population of ash borer. And so, you know, there are remedies for yard trees that are high value, but it basically means treating them on a regular basis just to prevent them from being attacked. But anything that is not protected is going to have problems. And, you know, what the hope is down the road is that we'll be able to develop some ash varieties that are resistant because, of course, where this thing comes from, ash borer is not a dominant kill every tree in sight type of pest, and their trees have natural resistance, ours do not, and that's why they're so susceptible. So I'm afraid it's just going to be kind of an ongoing, and ash is going to become really a quite rare tree, unless again you're talking about urban trees that are getting some sort of chemical treatment to keep the problem out.
Yeah, that's too bad. And you mentioned Dutch elm, and I just have to report for those who are UW-Madison campus alums, Elmer, the big elm tree, 100 years old, behind the biochemistry building, is one of the most beautiful elm trees I've ever seen, has finally succumbed to Dutch elm disease and has to come down. It was nicknamed Elmer, and it's really too bad. Really too bad. Ryan, thanks a lot for calling. It's unfortunately going to be the same thing with a lot of our ash trees. Jack in Barneveld, it's your turn. Hi, Jack.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You bet. What's on your mind?
We purchased a farm in Barneveld just about 12 months ago. And from what I understand about the history, I think it used to be a cattle farm at one point, and there's a barn on that property. It's about a 20 by 30 barn. Two stories, second story is a loft, and the previous owner totally remodeled it and brought it back to life, did a very good job. Exterior was completely redone, roof and walls and everything else. The inside of it's still all original, and we found in the spring that we have a very bad, what I think are just normal house flies problem inside that barn. where we'd go in, you know, almost on a daily basis and fill a dustpan of dead flies. There's so many in a not that large of a space. Pretty confident that they're not just coming in every day from the outside, because it's, you know, it's not super airtight, but with the renovations done to it, it's pretty well sealed up at this point. And my guess was is maybe they're laying eggs and hatching in the spring, and we're just seeing them all come out in the spring. But wondering if you had any advice on how to tackle that problem, assuming that it recurs in the following spring.
Well, you know, the thing, I would disagree about the breeding side of it, because, you know, there's a bunch of things that look like house flies, but the bottom line is, in order for them to develop, you have to have food for the maggots, and that would be identifiable. I mean, it's trash and debris in the case of house flies. We talk about those cluster flies, which honestly are earthworm breeders. So they breed outside and then come migrating in. Mm-hmm. There's also a couple of flies associated with livestock, in particular face flies, which will migrate into buildings in the fall. And then again, you heat the building up, or in the spring, you kind of re-see what's going on. So I think it'd be worth getting them identified. And again, you can take a sample and send it into the insect diagnostic lab, and PJ will take a look at it. In particular, because I think you can put your finger on exactly where the source is, and then we can start looking at it, what the options are. But again, I can't believe that there's anything going on that would allow them to breed. And so it's either they're migrating in, or, you know, some flies will come in the summer just to seek shelter for a short period of time. But if these things are piling up in the fall or the spring, as I said, I get more into these critters that are trying to spend the winter and are really hibernating in the building, and they get in up in the wall spaces and the like. And then when things warm up, they kind of re-waken up. You know, because you just got way too many critters there. And as I said, if they were breeding inside, that it would be quite obvious there was a source.
Thanks very much for that call. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, retired from the University of Wisconsin Department of Entomology. Great to have him back. And we will take some more calls right now. Mike in Milwaukee up next. Mike, your turn.
Hey, Phil and Larry. I got a single-family house with a basement, and the basement, there's a swarm of flies that came up the staircase towards the back door. I guess the flies like light. And so I went to Menards and bought some see-through sticky paper, which I put on the window up there, and they all stuck to it. So I had like 50, 60 flies on this paper. And that was the end of it. I thought, oh, boy, how intelligent I am. I was able to vanquish the flies, you know. But then about 4 days later, I get another swarm of the same kind of fly. And so I took the old paper off the window, the sticky paper, and I put up new ones. And sure enough, they all stuck to the paper, and maybe another 50 of these things. And that's it. And right now, I'm worried that I'm going to see another swarm come out of the basement.
Sure. Yeah. What do we got going there, Phil?
You know, my take on it is something died somewhere. Yeah. And you're seeing the flies that bred on that carcass. And what's typical of the insects associated with dead animals and carrion is either the flies are quite shiny. We call them blue bottles and green bottles because they're kind of metallic. Or they're quite bristly, because some of the sarcophagid flesh flies, again, they just have bigger bristles than the normal house fly. And what I'm guessing is you probably are done with it. If it was a large food source, a raccoon, let's say, I think, again, as we had talked about earlier, the odor would catch your attention. You know, it's unfortunate when you get a large food source like that, because, I mean, I can breed thousands of flies off a carcass like that. And so this is always the dilemma when you get this kind of emergence. Is it a wall void? Is it an attic space? Again, if you can find it, you clean it up. But if you don't know where it is, it's best to just let it run its course. And, you know, your solution is probably better than many, because as I said, I don't find fly sprays all that effective. And this can even happen in the winter. We had an incident a couple years ago in our house where I'd get about 6 or 7 flies in the basement a day. I knew they were associated with something that died. I couldn't smell anything. And it took me probably almost 2 weeks of daily going down with my little butterfly net, catching them. And I, like you saw, maybe 50, 60 flies. Never did identify it. I speculated something like a squirrel or smaller from the number of flies. And as I said, those are pretty typical. If you have a fireplace, it's always worth checking the flue, that something didn't die down there like a bird or the like. But as I said, if your nose hasn't told you where the problem is, I wouldn't be too concerned, because it can't be that big a food source, and it may be something you'll never, ever see in the house again.
I had the same issue, and it turned out in my garage, and it turned out that I had left a turkey tail feathers out there from, the whole tail feather batch, and they were coming off of that.
Sounds like you forgot to salt it.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. Oh, there you go, Mike. Thank you so much for calling. Diane in Kadad, it's your turn. Hi, Diane.
Good morning. I'm calling about the Japanese beetles, and I know they're kind of at the end of what they're doing, but I had a terrible invasion of them this year, more than last year, and I put up the traps, which only seem to invite more.
You're right.
We don't recommend traps other than, the joke is you get them for your neighbors, because the research tells us you get them worse when you have traps on your property than if you didn't have them. They make you feel good because you catch a bunch of them, but the ones you don't catch feed on your flowers. So, yeah, traps are not the way to go.
So a friend of mine told me about milky spore.
Okay, and I would say it's a great tool in the right circumstance, but it's not going to make any difference for you. Unfortunately, what we see for most of us is the Japanese beetles that attack our plants are flying in from down the road. Where a milky spore would be a good product is if they were breeding in your lawn, and then you could kill the grubs there and stop the problem. But what I tend to find is in most lawns, especially if they're not irrigated on a regular basis, like a golf course, is I might find one or two grubs per square foot, which is nothing. My colleague Chris Williamson talks about 60 and 80 grubs per square foot in a golf course. So when you think about where these things fly, and they can fly upwards of a mile or more, as I said, most of us are paying the price of them migrating in from outside our property, and they're doing this for 2 months. And there just is no easy solution. You can treat your plants, that lasts for 5 or 6 days. These things are flying for 2 months. And so it really is a difficult problem. And the only piece of hopefully good news I can give you is my experience in Madison. We're going back now almost 20 years, maybe probably 18 years of when the Japanese beetles were just absolutely bonkers. I live about two blocks from a golf course, and I will tell you the populations in my backyard this year, I mean, I could find them, but they're not even 5% of what they were during their heyday. And that's been my experience with talking to people, that for the most part is this builds, it gets really downright nasty for 4 or 5 years, and then over time it starts to improve. And that's what I'm hoping that you will experience. But it's hard for me to say. Now, bad winters, the numbers will go down. Very lush summers, the numbers go up. But as I said, in general, what has been quite pleasing to watch is how you tend to get more of a balance as you go down the road.
There you go, Diane. Thank you so much for calling. Al in Soldier's Grove, your turn. Hi, Al.
Hi, Larry and Phil. I'm really concerned about the overall population of native insects. Nobody seems to notice or care that they are disappearing. I can go for walks in the woods. I live in the country down in the Kickapoo Valley, and I don't see any spider webs in the woods. I don't see any moths around my light at night. I hardly see any bugs. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what's going on, if anybody else has noticed or how that's monitored.
We'd get the calls on the show over the years, and people say, when I'm driving around, I'm not hitting as many bugs on my car. And I used to speculate, well, maybe, some of its land use changes. And then somebody said, well, I live up in Duluth and things are the way that they've always been. And what got my attention, I don't know if you had seen the article, but about 2 months ago, there's a piece in the New York Times talking about some research that's been done for the last 3 or 4 decades in Germany in some natural settings, where they're monitoring insect biomass, the sheer number of insects, and it is down 60 to 70%.
Wow.
And so I think this whole thing that most of us are seeing, there aren't as many bugs flying around at the night lights and all those other things, is really a much more widespread phenomenon that people I think, first believed in exactly what's causing it. You know, people are speculating, but I don't think we really have a good answer to it. As I said, I'm sure that, you know, acres and acres of engineered corn and whatnot limits the number. But when you're in a wild setting like you are in the Kickapoo, where there's just lots of really neat, you know, natural type areas, you would expect more insects than there are. And so there definitely is in a decline, and that is a major concern.
That a major concern, because look at the bird life and the other animals that feed on those insects.
Yeah, it I mean, it's downright staggering when you see those kind of numbers. And I said, if people are interested, that there was a real nice piece in the New York Times within the last 2 months.
Thank you, Al, for calling. Diane wondered about the latest on jumping worms. Is soil remediation recommended here in the next minute or so?
Well, technically, jumping worms aren't an entomology problem. I will just relate that we found them for the first time in our yard last year. I almost didn't want to tell my wife because I knew she'd be disappointed. She's quite the gardener. But I have not seen them do anything. In fact, I haven't found a jumping worm yet this year. And so some of the recent research at the Arboretum tells us they're not having as much of an impact as people would think. And so I think the verdict is still out exactly where this is going.
And you can join in, too, with your questions or comments. Dennis and Deerfield will get to you in just a few minutes. But the number for you to call to join in, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And don't forget, if you've got a photo you want to send along in that email, Phil will try and take a look at it. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at the UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. We'll take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back with Phil. You stay with us. We are taking a look at the world of insects today here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at the UW-Madison. Always great to have Phil come by, and we have lots of callers online, so I think we're just going to go right back to the phones and to Dennis in Deerfield. Dennis, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hey, I've got a question about monarch butterflies and an observation about the Japanese beetles. I'm wondering, are the monarchs that are flying now, are they the ones that are going to fly south, or is there one more generation to come yet?
These will go, and there will be more monarchs added to the population in the next 3 weeks or so. But once you start getting into September, it starts to get kind of late if they lay eggs for things to have enough time to develop and emerge as adults. And so,
as far as the beetles go, apparently there's no predator for them. But this summer I noticed that, especially right towards the end of the season, that house finches and house sparrows, and one day I noticed some immature cardinals appeared to be, I've got a plant that the beetles love, and they appeared to be landing on the plant and grabbing beetles and eating them. Now, I couldn't get close enough to be sure they were grabbing a beetle, but is that something you've heard about, that birds are starting to take an interest?
Oh, yeah. I you know, it's just a sheer numbers game and the like. And, you know, the thing that we think is controlling their populations over time is more of a disease in the grub populations. That's at least what some of the research out east has said. But we do have a lot of things that feed on them. It's just that there's so darn many of them that, you know, and the birds don't specialize. You know, they can't taste too well because, you know, if they were really like cotton candy, you think the birds would just home in on them, and you don't see that. You get this kind of opportunist-type feeding. I do want to mention there was a paper that just came out of University of Kentucky and Dr. Potter down there with Japanese beetles and milkweed. And what they were finding is the Japanese beetles were feeding so extensively on the flowering of milkweed, it was reducing the seed production by 90%.
Oh.
So, you know, another reason to hate Japanese beetles is you can make the argument, because, you know, milkweed seed is in high demand now as people are trying to get more milkweed seed available. And what his students were finding is that this is going to be an impediment to that, is if you allow the Japanese beetles to get too much access, that it's going to affect seed production, which means we got less seed to produce more milkweed.
There you go, Dennis. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your questions. Let's go to Chris in Madison next. Hi, Chris.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
All right, my question is, for 15 years, I built a house, never had any bugs in the house whatsoever. The other day I was in the basement, all of a sudden a centipede crawled up between a crack. I noticed then, next day when I went to let the dogs out, centipede outside the front stoop, right by the front door as I opened it, was trimming maybe that day or the next day, another centipede on the side of the house. My question is it because of how hot and the moisture that all of a sudden I'm seeing these guys, or do I have a problem? Are they starting to invade? And it seems the ones on the outside were, as I remember as a kid when we had them, were the about inch-long, 1 million legs, where the one in the basement didn't look like that type of centipede I saw on the outside, but sure, actually was a version of it.
Well, yeah, and that's what I'm glad you clarified it, because we do have outside centipedes. They are predators, run around at night, do their hunting and the like, and you usually don't get overrun. You don't see the numbers. You know, we talk about the millipedes by the tens of thousands. If you found 15 centipedes, I go, oh, my. I mean, that's just not the numbers. But there is an indoor house centipede. It's something we don't find outdoors. Its legs are kind of longer and ganglier. It's scary looking to many people just because the way it runs so fast and wiggles around and the like. And they are predators indoors, so you can make the argument they're feeding on spiders and ticks, and or not ticks so much, ants, things that would be found indoors. But because that's kind of a desert, you never see a lot of centipedes indoors. And no, most likely the indoor house centipede you brought in on boxes of some sort. That's typically the way they're transported in. And, you know, I've had them in my basement. If I see two a year, that's about it. The more clutter you have in the basement where potentially they can hide, sometimes people would argue that gives you a few more. But as I said, I tell people you're never going to be overrun for them because they're slow breeding. There's just not enough to eat. So it's kind of a trickle in most cases. And so, as I said, I think you had two things going on. If you told me a lot of the outdoor centipedes were getting in, then I'd start talking about, you know, caulking cracks, caulking that interface between the siding so they can't squeeze up in there and fall in the basement. And if they do fall in the basement, it's a dead end for them because it's just not a good environment.
There you go. Thank you so much, Chris. Sarah and Nina, your turn. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I have a question about carpenter ants, which we think are living in a rotten windowsill that was wrapped with metal after the windows, or when the windows were replaced, but we're not certain that that's where they are. Mm-hmm. We've had them annually, and they seem to have gotten worse this year. We've not called anyone to come in and spray because we don't really want chemicals in the house, and we don't really want to tear out the window if that's not where they are. Do you have any recommendations as how to troubleshoot this or figure out where the problem is?
So give me an idea of the pattern of what's been going on as far as where you're seeing the ants and that kind of thing.
Yeah, they come into my daughter's bedroom, and they kind of start to bloom in mid-July. And then we have them we still have them, but they've tapered off a little bit.
Okay. There's no question. I mean, your observations are really good. But, you know, if I'm seeing them in the kitchen, then I start to question, are they coming in from outside? When you see them in a place where there's not much food, that all makes sense. And in the lateness of it, you know, all that fits. So if there's any kind of pre-existing opening, you know, in the windowsill, from the outside and the like, what I'd suggest is go to the hardware store, just get whatever ant spray. But what you're looking for is one that has one of those little red applicator straws, like you'd see on a WD-40 can. And what that allows you to is pinstream the spray way into the wall void, where it will do the most good. So one of the options you've got, again, is just to spot treat the place you're suspicious of, and it's not going to be out in your living space, so it's not like your daughter's going to be exposed, and that's the best way to apply the stuff. Now, if that doesn't work, one of the things that has changed in the last 10 years with carpenter ant control, one of the old ways of doing it, whether you did it yourself or you contract for service, is the pest control service would come and they'd spray the outside foundation. The spray they used would repel the ants, which didn't mean you controlled them. You just stopped them from coming in. Everybody seemed to be happy. And then next year you had ants again. And so that really was not the best way, but at least it kept ants out of the house and kept people reasonably satisfied. There's a new product that's come on the market, and it does not repel the ants. And the interesting thing is if the ants walk through it, they will literally pick it up and transfer it to other ants. It is commercially sold as the product Termidor and is applied by a pest control service. So you could have somebody come and spray your house once, and it will solve your indoor ant problem because they have to go outside for food. They have to walk through it. The positive there is you're not treating the inner living space at all. So that's one option. to be honest, you can go on the internet and buy this stuff from one of these pest control services if you want to apply, you know, the do-your-own pest controls. The active ingredient is fipronil, which is what is put on dogs as frontline. And so it's a product. It is not registered for indoor use, but it is registered for outdoor use for ant control. And as I said, in other forms, it's put on animals. And this has made carpenter ant control much easier because you don't have to know where the nest is. You just basically have to surround them. And some research out of Washington State suggested you're even killing carpenter ant colonies could be 50 yards away from the house because the ants were coming into the house for food. They'd walk through the product. They'd pick up enough that they would transfer it. So that would be the, you know, if I got to get rid of the ants, the fipronil treatment would be a way to go. But for now, I think I would suggest that, you know, $4, $5 for a can of ant spray that would allow you to treat into that windowsill however you can find a little seam. Sometimes people even go as far as drilling a very small hole to allow you to get in there and then just put a little piece of caulk or something to seal that up. But I think you've got them centered and located, and that's the secret to carpenter ant control, really.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling, Sarah. Let's turn to Norm in Oneida County next. Hi, Norm.
Good afternoon. Another question on the monarch butterfly.
Okay.
Last year I let the milkweed come back, and nothing much happened. This year it came back real thick, unfortunately, by the door. But anyway, I'm getting monarchs coming in this year. My question is, are they still endangered, or are they making a comeback?
Well, I mean, the nice thing about living in Wisconsin, the last 2 years have been some of the best monarch years I have seen in the recent 20 years. So, you know, if you just use our observations of Wisconsin, you'd say, you know, things are getting better. But the weakness or bottleneck of these critters is they all go down to Mexico to spend the winter. The habitat that they're getting in Mexico is diminishing. There's also some climate issues that people are bringing up that are of concern. And so, you know, they're not endangered like some insects are to the point that they're almost extinct. But I think everybody is worried biologically that this problem of where they're spending the winter, how fragile that environment, how small an area it really is, it's really prone to potentially catastrophes. And so that's why I think everybody has been doing whatever they can to try to get the populations up in North America so we have more monarchs going down there, which gives us hopefully a better chance of having populations come back and building.
There we go. Thanks, Norm. I appreciate the call. Jerry in Madison, your turn.
Yes, thank you. I was just wondering if it's the seventh year for locusts, because I seem to see a lot of locusts this year, and they seem to be in ash trees. I don't know if that's just common or just and what they eat. I don't even know.
Okay, so they're not locusts, they're cicadas. A locust to an entomologist is a type of grasshopper. But the things that buzz in the trees are cicadas. And we have about six species of native cicadas. The one that we hear most often is called the dog day cicada. And it has a three-year life cycle. But there is also one version that we have in the state that has a 17-year life cycle. And that will not emerge until 2024. In very localized areas. We see it down in Lake Geneva. We see it down in Janesville. We don't get it in Madison. So we're a ways away from it. So the one you are seeing is the dog day cicada. And late summer, usually from the middle of July on, you tend to see those critters. And they feed on the roots of various trees. So you got to have trees or forests around for them to go. And then the adults will go up in the top of the trees and sing, both to attract a mate and the like. So they're neat critters. And I've almost come to the point when they start singing, you start thinking, you know, it's about time for the kids to think going back to school, unfortunately. So as a kid, I was not real keen on hearing them because it suggested the summer was going to the end.
There you go. And speaking of cicadas.
Oh, yes. So, you know, you can tell the species by the calls. And I think the site is still up. There was a site at the University of Michigan on cicada calls in North America. And if you heard them, you can compare it to see which species we have in the area. And if you go much south of us, there's one called a scissor grinder. And instead of having that nice, even tone, it goes up and down, which to some people is more annoying. You know, it just depends. And honestly, I have a couple times heard scissor grinders, even one in my own neighborhood. And so that was kind of fun for me because I could identify we had a species that we normally didn't get just by the way it tends to vibrate. So
very cool. Sarah found that for us. Thanks, Sarah. We have an email about ticks. Steve wondered if it's true that amber can repel ticks. He told his wife it was mumbo jumbo after she put some amber necklaces on her dogs.
Yeah, I have seen no research, and I don't know what amber would have that would keep ticks away. You know, you know, the various products that we use on our clothing and whatnot, you know, some are sold as true repellents like DEET. And a repellent is supposed to make things go to somewhere else. But the products that really are more effective are often have acaricidal or killing powers. And so the permethrin product that's put on clothing and the like doesn't just repel them, it kills them. And that's why it seems to be offer added protection than just using a repellent per se.
Let's take another call. Luba in Madison, your turn. Hi, Luba.
Hi. I have a question. I found two of these in the soil, and they're about a one inch long, and they're narrow at both ends. They have red mahogany color coloring. It's kind of a soft shell. And I think I detected tiny feelers at one end. And it did wiggle once at one end. And then on the top, it was two-thirds smooth. And at the bottom of the top shell, it was one-third with three rings. And underside, it was all rings.
You know, I'm guessing it's a beetle larvae, but there are just so many species. I'm not sure which. It's a ground beetle or somebody else. You know, unfortunately, the kind of things you need to identify them is you count the number of segments on the antennae and all these other kind of subtle little things. So I'm not sure I can do much more for you. If you get a chance to take a picture, I think that would be helpful just because, as I said, it would give me a little bit more of a perspective. But I'm pretty sure it is a beetle larvae of one sort or another.
There you go. Thank you, Luba. And Judy in La Crosse. Hi.
Yes. Hello. We have what I read online are called cicada-burying wasps. Mm-hmm. They dig holes in the yard and bury these something, cicadas,
yes,
and then lay their eggs there. And some years we'll have maybe 50 of these holes, which are almost like a mole hole. What can we do to get rid of those wasps? This year is not as bad so far.
Yeah. One of the things you can do, so when we get these in flower beds, we find out if we mulch the flower bed, they don't dig into it. In lawns, I guess I would say really lush, thick lawns don't give you any bare soil, and they don't seem to want to dig in that. They're always looking for kind of bare areas to dig their little holes in. So that really, I think, changing the environment would be more effective. Now, their numbers kind of come and go a little bit depending on the cicada populations. They are very non-aggressive as far as the case of stinging you. In fact, a lot of what you see are males, and they don't even have stingers. But they're very territorial. They honestly fly back and forth to keep the other males out of the area, so people get the impression I got this huge nest, and they're the biggest, scariest-looking wasps we've got in the state by far. I've never talked to somebody that has been stung by a female. If you captured one and bothered enough, you could get stung, and I don't think that would be a pleasant because they're big enough. I have a feeling they pack a bit of wallop. But as I said, so it's more the nuisance of having them around. If you don't feel that you can get the lawn thick enough, you know, again, like we talked about the ground nesting wasp, you can blow a little dust in each one of the holes to knock them out. But that is a fix for this year. That doesn't mean they're not coming back next year. I will tell you, though, they do seem to come back to the same areas.
Oh.
You know, the males are very, that's why they're territorial. They emerge from the ground and they kind of fly around that area waiting for another female to come back and start things over again. And so we're late enough now, you're not going to see, you know, they should have started second week of July. And again, the cicada populations are getting towards the end. So once we get into the end of August, I really don't care about them. But, you know, think about, as I said, either fertilizing lawn, reseeding it, getting it more dense, that would stop them out of there. And if it's in a flower bed area that they're working, just mulch it, you know, with wood chips or whatnot, and they won't mess with you.
Thanks for calling, Judy. Appreciate it. And Eric and Rice Lake, your turn.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Larry.
Sure.
How do I get rid of cellar spiders? I seem to get a whole bunch of them every summer. Lots of webs. They're not as bad in the wintertime, but they're always there.
You know, spiders are always tough. I honestly think getting the shop vac out and getting up in the corners, you know, and put on a way of making sure you get back in the seams and corners, and just spending, you know, a half hour getting up in the woodwork per se in the cellar probably is as effective as anything else. You know, like most spiders, they feed on insects. So you can, you know, try to seal the outside to prevent insects from migrating in, which means there's less spider food, and that will hopefully help you a little bit. But as I said, they don't behave well as far as sprays. Most sprays aren't as effective as you might think on spiders, and that's why I like more the physical type of knocking their populations down, and then it will take them quite some time to rebuild.
Thanks, Eric. Appreciate the call. Scott sent in some photos, insect-related, on sumac, and
it looks like a gall of some sort.
Yeah, gall on sumac.
If you cut that open, what's tough about galls, these are plant responses to an insect being present. My first guess looking at that bulb-like structure, that this could be an aphid gall, and you open it up, and it's going to look like New York City because there's all these little aphids living in it. But don't be surprised if it might just be a little white grub of some sort, which would be more beetle or moth-like. As I said, I'm not particularly familiar with that. I'm, you know, if I had my gall Bible, I could look it up. Yeah, it's so interesting in entomology. A lot of the classic books are old publications. So I inherited this from Chuck Koval back when I first started back in the 70s. And it was a book written in the 40s. And
oh,
if I
goodness.
Ever have a question on gall insects, I bring that book out and be darned, it solves it about 99% of the time.
Oh, man, good stories. Well, did we talk about magnolia scales?
No, PJ will be on in a month, and it will be the prime time for treating. But the main thing about that insect is they're starting to appear almost like a white cotton candy infestation on the magnolias. It's still too early to treat. The window of opportunity is in mid-September. So that's the thing. You know, so many insects, we talk about treating in the spring. This one is a fall application.
And let's see, there were webworms can appear in the fall, can't they?
Yeah, so we get tent caterpillar in the spring. There is a critter called the fall webworm, and fall webworm gets on lots of different trees, birch, hickory, and the like. One of the things about insects that eat late in the season, they have less impact on the plant than those that feed in early in the season. When insects strip all the leaves off early in the season, the plant has to respond by making new leaves. That weakens the plant. But when insects eat things this late in the season, it's not much different than what's going to happen naturally in a month or so. And so I don't get concerned. You see a great big web up in a tree, just let it be. This late in the season, they should be kind of winding down. And so it's not that big a concern. And as I said, what you see in the fall has got nothing to do with the critters you see in the spring. They're different critters. So,
well, Phil, on that note, we are out of time. Thanks so much for joining us. You'll be back on, let's see, October 17th.
We'll do this
all over again. Phil Pelletieri is an entomologist, Distinguished Faculty Associate Emeritus. He retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab in 2014, and he comes in every other month, and P.J. Leash comes in the opposite month to talk with you about insects. And Phil's next back on October 17th. So great to have him along, and thanks so much for listening in. Many parts of the state have had downpours this summer, and tomorrow at this time, vehicle maintenance specialist Jim Ward will be back to tell you about what to know about the effects of rain and standing water on your car. That'll be at 11. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. Please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.